This is Bill Damski, and you're listening to Apologetics Profile.
David Hume, the early mid-18th century skeptic of all things miraculous, claimed in his posthumously published work, Dialogues Concerning Natural Religion, that our own experience of observing things created by man is insufficient grounds for thinking that the universe was therefore created by God. Hume, through the character of Philo, claims, quote, "When two species of objects have always been observed to be conjoined together, I can infer by custom the existence of one whenever I see the existence of the other, and this I call an argument from experience. But how this argument can have place where the objects, as in the present case, are single, individual, without parallel or specific resemblance, may be difficult to explain. And will any man tell me with a serious countenance that an orderly universe must arise from some thought and art like the human, because we have experience of it? To ascertain this reasoning, it were requisite that we had experience of the origin of worlds, and it is not sufficient, surely, that we have seen ships and cities arise from human art and contrivance." End quote. Hume, through Philo, says that in order to claim God created the universe, we would need to have witnessed in some capacity the origin of other worlds. Since no human being has ever observed the origin of this universe or of other worlds, we ought not to infer that God created the universe. But must we have first-hand experience of something to be able to recognize intelligent agency and design? This is an impossible epistemic burden, for it would require us to experience firsthand everything we claim to be true. And it cannot possibly be the case that the truth of an event or a claim rests upon whether Hume or anyone else has actually observed it. It would make most every attempt at understanding the past impossible. Science itself would be impossible. In the early 20th century, astronomers, for example, were taken aback by the notion that their data seemed to be suggesting the universe had an actual beginning. Time, space, matter, and energy, everything, seemed to have come into being ex nihilo, from a point of origin. Of course, no scientist had the ability to actually see the beginning of the universe, yet they could make solid logical inferences from what they could see. The idea of a finite universe was quite disturbing for many scientists of the time. Sir Arthur Eddington, for example, who did pioneering work in the physics of stars, hated the idea of the universe having a beginning. He lamented, quote, "Philosophically, the notion of a beginning of the present order is repugnant to me. I should like to find a genuine loophole. I simply do not believe the present order of things started off with a bang. The expanding universe is preposterous. It leaves me cold." End quote. As Discovery Institute Director of Science and Culture Dr. Stephen C. Meyer notes in his 2021 book, The Return of the God Hypothesis, a finite universe, quote, "would force scientists to confront the uncomfortable questions about the ultimate beginning of the material universe itself. It also raised the possibility that the universe had begun in something like a creation event, produced by a cause that existed independently of matter, space, time, and energy." End quote. A creation event. What could have possibly brought our universe into existence? What finally is responsible for the arrangement of the sun, moon, and stars? Why is Earth habitable? From where did biological life originate? For us as Christians, the answer, of course, is God. But no one has seen God at any time, the Apostle John writes in the first chapter of his gospel account. Yet we can understand God both through what he has revealed to us through his Son, the Lord Jesus Christ, through what he has revealed in the Bible, and through what creation reveals. The Apostle Paul declares, for example, in the opening chapter of Romans, that we can infer God's existence through the physical cosmos and everything it contains. Quote, For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse." End quote. Since the early 1990s, the idea of intelligent design has come to the forefront of the dialogue between Christianity and science. Though many within the intelligent design community are not specifically religious, there is a growing body of intellectuals who find ID as having tremendous explanatory scope and power in relation to the findings of modern cosmology and biology. Design in nature seems to them to be far more than coincidental or illusory. Design in nature is indeed making a comeback. Arguably, the cultural decline of intelligent design in nature can be largely attributed to Charles Darwin's 1859 publication, Origin of Species. Darwin provided a theoretical alternative to design, which became a foundational paradigm for, as neurosurgeon Michael Egnor puts it, quote, "the accompanying tsunami of atheist ideology," end quote. Egnor observed that since Darwin, quote, "a new age of atheistic faith inundated the scientific world," it seemed that biological design could be explained away by invoking Darwinian random heritable variation and natural selection, end quote. Egnor's observations can be found in the foreword of the recently updated and revised second edition of one of the landmark texts of the intelligent design movement. William Dembski and co-author Winston Ewart's The Design Inference, Eliminating Chance Through Small Probabilities. The Design Inference is daunting, thorough, and comprehensive in what it argues. Their book is not merely arguing on the basis of improbability alone, as many critics have accused them, but improbability and specification. Dembski is both a mathematician and philosopher. He currently serves as a founding and senior fellow with Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. He is also a distinguished fellow with the Institute's Walter Bradley Center for Natural and Artificial Intelligence. You can find out more about Bill's work on his personal website at billdembski.com. That's Dembski, D-E-M-B-S-K-I.com, and at discovery.org. Consider dumping a jar of 10,000 pennies on the floor. There are a virtual innumerable multitude of possible arrangements they could take on the floor, all of them equally improbable. But what if one of those arrangements happened to spell out $100? This arrangement is just as improbable as any other possible arrangement, but the specification of the pennies spelling out $100 is a signifier that some kind of design is surely to be involved. As Dembski notes, the design inference isn't just a formal mathematical argument, but is something we use in everyday life.
These sorts of arguments, they have a lot of force. One of the examples I consider in the second edition of the design inference is the Bernie Madoff scandal. There's a quant named Harry Markopoulos who just skewered the SEC because, I mean, he saw years before that this had to be a Ponzi scheme. And he was constantly contacting them. But the interesting thing is he saw, when he was looked at the data within 4 minutes, he saw that it was a Ponzi scheme. It was a very simple design inference that he drew.
Dembski believes the design inference, though it does not mention specifically who or what the designer might be, nevertheless helps clear away many intellectual barriers that non-Christians might have toward belief in God.
I don't see that there's a direct path in the sense that Jesus is the designer, you know, or anything like that. But where I see intelligent design's role in apologetics, and this is what Apologetics Profile, the program, is that it clears away so much of the rubbish in our culture, in our educational system, that tries to make it implausible to believe in God, to believe in Jesus, to believe that the Bible is an accurate accounting of what God has done in salvation history. So, you know, there's traditionally two books, you know, of revelation. There's the book of nature, the book of scripture. And I think what intelligent design does is it gets right the book of nature. And if we get the book of nature wrong, we're going to have problems understanding the book of scripture. So that's where I see its role.
As we begin our conversation, Dembski shared with me how the first 1998 publication of The Design Inference came about. Here is Bill Dembski.
If you're a materialist or, you know, atheist, then design is something that comes at the end of an evolutionary process. It can be a cosmological evolution, it can be a biological evolution, but intelligence is something that's an afterthought of natural history, as it were. It's not built in. So you've got this mindless material universe that's unfolding, and then through a process of natural selection or whatever, you have these intelligent agents that come on the scene. And so chance, in some sense, then is fundamental. Now, when you try to understand chance, though, probabilistically, you find that just about anything that happens is highly improbable. And things that would call forth design for you are just as improbable as things that call forth chance. So if I throw a thousand marbles on the floor, precise configuration of those marbles is going to be highly improbable. But then what happens if those marbles spell out, "Welcome to Apologetics Profile"? Now you got to say, there's something else going on there.
Right.
So the thing is, I approached, and so I was at a conference on randomness. The paper you described was Randomness by Design, published it in 1991 with the philosophical journal Nous, but came out of a conference at Ohio State University in 1998. It was organized by Percy Diaconis at Stanford and Harvey Friedman at Ohio State. And the upshot of that conference, I mean, it was focused on randomness. It was titled Randomness. But the upshot of the conference, when everything was concluded, was, we know what randomness isn't. We don't know what it is. Okay. And the fundamental intuition with randomness is that something is random as long as you don't see a pattern in it. But then once you do see a pattern in it, you won't unsee it. It's got to be the right sort of pattern. So for instance, if you look at something like a Rorschach test, it looks like a random ink blot, but then suddenly you see, oh, that's a skull, or that's a woman combing her hair in the mirror. Then you say, wait a second, that wasn't the result of chance. Okay. And so randomness on this traditional view was then this thing that we didn't understand, but then we understood non-randomness. Well, if we understand non-randomness, shouldn't that be the fundamental thing? And then isn't randomness really, so if design, non-randomness is the fundamental thing, then randomness is, as it were, a byproduct of design. So it flips the problem on its head. It's basically saying things are non-random provisionally as long as we don't see a salient pattern in them. Once we see the pattern, then it's non-random.
Gotcha.
It's design.
Gotcha. Gotcha.
So that's flipping the problem. And so it makes randomness really parasitic on design. You know, you can't, in a sense, make sense out of randomness apart from design.
Right.
Okay. So that was the point of that article. And it was well received. I mean, as a consequence of that article, I was invited. There was a big 8-volume Encyclopedia of Philosophy that Routledge did in 1998. And so I was asked to do the randomness article on that. So this was well-received work. Ended up in the consequences or implications I took from it were unsettling, let's just say, for some people. And that's where I got into trouble.
Yes.
And that's why I'm not on faculty at some prestigious university at this point.
Understood. So it seemed that from what I was reading of the history of the first edition of the Design Inference in came out in 1998. It's been 25 years. Congratulations on
thank you.
Redoing it and giving it a facelift. I didn't read the first edition. I've gotten probably 3/4 of the way through the second edition in preparation for our interview. But the book itself in 1998 was published on Cambridge University Press, as I understand it. And by itself, it was not itself the thing that stirred the enormity of the controversy which followed, Bill. It seemed to be that when you applied the design inference to biology is when you got in trouble. Is that accurate?
That's right. Yeah, that's right. I mean, I don't know if I want to say I was being cagey, but I think I had already had some experience with biology and the sort of controversy that these ideas might be creating. So in the first edition of the design inference, I simply applied it to a lot of human context. So data falsification, cryptography, plagiarism, SETI, search for extraterrestrial intelligence. So there were lots of examples where I could just run this design inferential engine and say, okay, this is where design is relevant. This is how you infer it in these situations. I did consider origin of life in the design inference first edition, but I simply was looking at how this sort of inference might apply when creationists versus atheists look at it. But I didn't lay my cards on the table. I didn't say, okay, and this is where I stand on this. So I just showed how the method applies. You know, this is the thing. It's a method. But then the natural thing is, you know, methods don't really care where you focus them. So what happens when you do focus it on biological systems? What happens when you actually try to come to terms? Is there real design in biology at the origin of life, in the subsequent history of life? And that's where, that's where I ran into a lot of conflict.
Now, after, I think it was in 99, about a year after the book came out, offered a professorship at Baylor here in Texas. Is that correct? You started in 99? Right. Was that when it was begun?
Yeah, it was. So the book came out fall of 98, and I'd known Robert Sloan, who was president of Baylor. He had made it clear he wanted to get me on faculty. This was back even in 1996, but he was looking for some opportunity to do it. At the time, Baylor was not a research university, so I wasn't interested in teaching a lot of courses there. I wanted to get on with the research. And so after that book came out, he had some of his people contact me and said, you know, how can we get you on faculty? And at that point, I was still a golden boy. You know, it was like, what can we do? You know, and I Templeton Foundation was still very open to intelligent design. I got a $100,000 Templeton grant at the end of that year. So everything, all the stars, it seemed, were aligned. And so they made me an offer. I was given a nice title of associate research professor in the Conceptual Foundations of Science. I did not have a departmental affiliation. I was hired to do a center. It was called the Michael Polanyi Center, and it was be focused on complexity, information, and design. And so that's what I did. I had a co-director, Bruce Gordon, and we were doing our research. We were doing some faculty seminars, and then also we arranged a really big conference called The Nature of Nature. We had two Nobel laureates there, Christian De Duve and Steven Weinberg from down in Austin. It was represented with different perspectives. You had the more straight up intelligent design perspective, the more theistic evolutionary perspective, Howard Van Til, Nancy Murphy, and then the straight up naturalistic, materialistic perspective was there. And it was a terrific conference. And we had finally ended up years later getting a quasi-conference proceedings called The Nature of Nature. But within 3 days of that conference, the Faculty Senate voted, I think it was 27-2, to shut my center down.
You know, wow.
It was, too much success. they did not want... I think that I wasn't unaware or didn't fully appreciate the sort of the history at Baylor with the moderate versus conservative Baptist conflict, and this was just a bridge too far for a number of them. They saw this as bringing us back to, you know, they equated intelligent design with creationism, with fundamentalism. You know, they're different, but they made that identification, and that was at that point, I quickly became persona non grata. The administration was looking for ways to get me out of my contract. I had to hire a lawyer to, you know, stand up for my academic freedoms. I was supposed to be at a congressional briefing in May of 2000, not a hearing, a briefing. So it was just to let members of Congress know about some of these ideas about intelligent design and why it was legit. And administration stopped me from going. They basically said, if you go, we will remove you from your position.
Wow.
And then I ended up staying on at Baylor essentially as a contract employee. I had 5 years on a contract. They paid me. I never taught, you know, it's funny because I was on faculty and people say, well, what did you teach? And I never taught anything at Baylor because I was not permitted to teach there, because any department that would have had me teach would have gotten into trouble with other people who didn't want me to have any role at the university. I had two books with InterVarsity that came out, Intelligent Design, The Bridge Between Science and Theology, and then The Design Revolution. Both of those got the first prize from Christianity Today for, I think, the best book in science and culture, or society and culture, or something like that. I don't recall the exact. And never in my time at Baylor were any of these achievements touted in their press. If you were just looking at what was in the Baylor PR materials, you would not know that I was on faculty there. I'm sorry, I don't want to belabor this, you know, but it's just, you know, in terms of cancel culture and all of that, I learned of it back in 2000. So when I saw it emerge the last few years, you know, it's like,
there,
okay,
it is again.
Been there, done
yeah,
that.
Yeah, well, and it's important, I think, to understand the nature of this conflict with intelligent design and how it's grown in the last several decades. It's interesting, yeah, too, Bill, because I'm somewhat of a fan of Michael Polanyi's work. He's helped me intellectually and epistemologically understand, having a way to understand the bridge, if you will, between Christianity, faith, and science. And Polanyi was a chemist, I believe, who sort of transitioned into philosophy and has this whole body of knowledge that he calls tacit or personal knowledge. And if I'm reading Polanyi correctly, the thing that impressed me most about his foresight in thinking about these things was that in science or anything that we do, there's this thing, to be colloquial, I'm not quoting him directly, that called the aha moment that sort of advances scientific paradigms, where a scientist has a brilliant flash of insight. But that his whole argument is that scientists don't leave their personality, their personal knowledge, their experiential knowledge at the lab door. They indeed bring this all into how they do science. And you talk a little bit about, in the design inference, you talk about how the knowledge that we have, the argument that you build, is built upon what we would tacitly call common sense anyway, that the design inference is not just a specific scientific insight, but as you say in the book, it's something that we all do every day. Yep. You're just trying to put some mathematical skin on this. But I wanted to read a quote from Polanyi and have you comment on this nature of knowledge in science and talk about the common sense or more common everyday aspect of the design inference that we all do. But Polanyi says this in his book on personal knowledge. He says that every kind of human knowing, ranging from perception to scientific observation, includes an appreciation of both order, contrasted to randomness, and of the degree of this order. We have seen that information theory, which you talk about, ascribes, in fact, a numerical value to the degree of order present in an ordered system forming a message. Such dynamic interaction between order and randomness is a necessary and sufficient condition for the applicability and of probability statements to mechanical systems. And so Polanyi is echoing what you're saying, in a sense, that we have this everyday common knowledge that we apply, and that probability and randomness works only in a universe where we first have, paradigmatically, the ability to recognize design in everything we do.
Yeah, I mean, it's no accident that I called the center in honor of Polanyi, and I just pulled out the first edition of The Design Inference. And let me just read this is the very opening, the preface. Highly improbable events don't happen by chance. Just about everything that happens is highly improbable. Both claims are correct as far as they go. The aim of this monograph is to show just how far they go. In Personal Knowledge, Michael Polanyi, so it's about sentence number 4 in the book, he considers stones placed in a garden. In one instance, the stones spell "Welcome to Wales" by British Railways. In the other, they appear randomly strewn. In both instances, the precise arrangements of stones is vastly improbable. Okay, and so on. You know, so that's, I mean, he's working that same intuition. I mean, there's the same thing, in Chemical Engineering News, he was looking at the information in DNA, and that the DNA itself, it allows for complete random rearrangements. So how is it that some of those arrangements are salient, can code for proteins, can do biologically useful stuff? And it's very rare, those arrangements that can do something biologically useful. So these design inferences are implicit right there in his observations. I would add that the hardcore darwinist is going to say, well, yes, they may be very rare, but the thing is, they evolve from other proteins or DNA sequences, and so it's not as though you're just getting them from scratch. There's an evolutionary path. So there's an argument that they would make, and I would say there's a problem with this sort of evolvability story, because it's got to start somewhere, and when you look at the actual probabilities, even factoring in the Darwinian mechanism, you don't really help yourself. So I'm this is just by the way, you know, but I just want to let the people who are listening in on this, that this is not just a I'm not just making a naive argument that there are just all these possibilities and look at how improbable this is. It's not just sheer improbability. We have to look at the actual stochastic processes that are involved for the evolvability, and then you also have to look at the salient patterns, or the specifications, as I call them, because you need a pattern there. Just highly improbable things, if there's not a suitable pattern, you don't need to invoke design. Chance is just
right. That's the argument that's commonly evoked. But I want to ask you this before we get too much further with this, just for some clarification, because as I'm reading the literature and the background and reading your book, that it struck me that chance and luck, if you will, Richard Dawkins uses luck and improbability. We're talking about these entities, if you will, for lack of a better word, these concepts of chance and luck, if you will. Dawkins has that book, Mount Improbable. But what it seems to me, Bill, is that they're using this language of chance and luck as though chance and luck had causal powers, in a sense, that we say chance, we say luck, or the opposition to design inference says chance or luck. But it's not, it's almost like it's described as a fifth fundamental force of some kind, that the chance itself had causal properties or causal powers. But to be fair to them, would you say that this idea of chance and luck, that they would come back with, well, it's the laws of physics, it's the laws of nature, it's the laws of biology that give us these things? How does the erudite and more sensible Darwinian or naturalist further explain how chance and luck, what they are, and how they're powered if they themselves are not causal?
Yeah, I mean, the ontology of chance, if you will, I mean, it's something I deal with, the metaphysics of chance in the inference. Mm-hmm. And again, there it's turning the problem on its head, seeing chance as a byproduct or epiphenomenon of design. And I I'm persuaded of that view. But, you know, I think, yes, you know, you can do an ontology of chance. I mean, there are people who've done that. I think Karl Popper had a propensity view of chance, where it's just a propensity of things to have a certain probabilistic character. But I think I'm not sure I need to ascribe to Dawkins a view of chance as a causal power. I think it's enough just to take a pragmatic descriptive view of it. And then, you know, it's just, I mean, there, you know, I flip a coin 100 times, I look at it, and I don't see any pattern in there. I ascribe it to chance. Okay. That seems reasonable to me. But if I flip that coin, treat heads as one, zero, tails as zeros, and then in some Unicode, it spells out the first words of Hamlet's soliloquy, you know, then I say, wait a second, there's something funny going on here. And so then I'm going to say, okay, there's a designing agent, there's an intelligent cause that's behind this. But just what's fundamentally behind, you know, if I just flip a coin and I don't see anything there, is it some sort of irreducible chance? Is at some level quantum indeterminacy, is that producing it? And are there some hidden variables? That was Einstein right that really everything is deterministic? And we just, you know, and so in a sense, chance is just an ignorance of physical laws. You know, that may be, you know, but I, you know, I'm not sure it's relevant to my argument. You know, this is one of the things I do. I try to say, you know, whatever your views on chance, you know, there are certain types of conclusions you're going to be drawing from certain situations. And, you know, and so I just want to really allow as wide a conception of chance, but then I also want to narrow things down and say, no, but if you're dealing with, as with the design inference, the specification, small probability arguments, then you have an explanatory burden. I mean, there's something you need to do, and you need to, you know, design comes to the fore. So that's what I would say.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's I don't know if you know the movie. This is a colloquial example. The 1959 movie Rio Bravo with John Wayne. His character was a sheriff, John T. Chance.
Okay.
And there's a scene in the movie, and this just came to mind as I was reading the last couple of days. There's a scene in the movie where they're playing cards, yeah, right? And Wayne's character Chance discovers that his opponents are winning with a frequency that just shouldn't be, and he suspects that there's cheating going on, and comes to discover that the deck of cards that were being used at the table were missing three aces, and that was in the pocket of the guy in the checkered vest, and he was using these aces to his own interest, of course. But I say all that to say that reminded me of what you're saying, in a sense that Wayne's character Chance can only recognize cheating because there's at base the schematic of the 52 card deck, that he knows how that's supposed to be arranged. He knows the rules of how the game should be played, and he knows the statistical anomalies of winning a hand several times in a row. And this seems to be what you're saying, in a sense, that we can recognize, and you apply this to in practical applications, and you do mention cards a couple of times, where cheating is a design inference. It's not a scientifically, you know, astute thing. It's something that we do all the time, that Wayne's character recognizes cheating because there's design that enables him to recognize cheating. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I think it is, but I, you know, let me nuance it a little bit. You know, it's one thing if you've got a smoking gun. So I think I saw Rio Bravo maybe 40 years ago or more, you know. But it's one thing if you find those three cards in the guy with the checkered vest's pocket, you know. There you've got a smoking gun, you know. And I think in a lot of design, you don't have to draw a design inference, you know. You just see, you know, you see the person pull the trigger, you know. But the design inference becomes necessary and interesting when you have an effect and then you have to try to read back to what the cause was and whether it was intelligence. And so we have these sorts of situations all the time. You know, is that, you look at a mound, is that a burial mound? Is that just a naturally formed mound? That rock, you know, is that an arrowhead? Is it just a random chunk of rock? I mean, you're just confronted with the rock. You don't see the causal story of how it got there. And so that's then the challenge. It's to say, when we don't have the smoking gun, when we don't have a video camera that tells us how it came about, are there features of an event, object, or structure that would tell us that it is a consequence of intelligent agency? And that's where this design inference comes in. And, you know, we use it in all sorts of cases. I mean, a very interesting case, I mean, we've got actually two university presidents who've recently had to resign, one for data falsification, the other for plagiarism. More recent case, plagiarism was Claudine Gay at Harvard. The other case was Mark Tessier-Levine at Stanford, who had been fraudulently using and reusing data in his research articles. And when that was
his own data, right? As I understand it, he was copying from himself.
I mean, that's you know, yeah. But I mean, you know, it's one thing if you're copying text that you've written, you know, one place elsewhere. But the thing is, these were supposed to be separate experiments establishing separate results. And so basically he's taking, and you're seeing the same sorts of error distributions and whatnot, you know, and that's, you know, and I think he has tried to do a little two-step around this by saying that he did not actually, you know, there's no video of him actually manipulating that data. So I think, you know, there are multiple authors, and so he can try to wash his hands of it. But the fact is, he had to resign from Stanford this last summer, you know, and it was actually an undergrad, not just undergrad, a freshman who outed him, you know. So these are, if you will, not just academic matters, although they impinge on the academy. You know, I mean, these sorts of arguments, they have a lot of force. One of the examples I consider in the second edition of the design inference is the Bernie Madoff scandal. There's a quant named Harry Markopoulos who just skewered the SEC because, I mean, he saw years before that this had to be a Ponzi scheme. And he was constantly contacting them. But the interesting thing is, he saw, when he was looked at the data within 4 minutes, he saw that it was a Ponzi scheme. It was a very simple design inference that he drew. He just looked at, you know, the thing with Bernie Madoff was not so much that he had the best return, but that they were so distant. Even at its best, you know, you might have 2 months of good returns for 1 month of bad. So 2 steps forward, 1 step back. For him, it was virtually always one step, you know, it was always a step forward. I think out of 85 or 90 months, I think he only had 3 months of losses, whereas I think the Standard and S&P, I think, were 23 months. So it was, then basically he just did a little binomial calculation, and, you know, he was looking at an improbability of 1 in 40 billion. And I think in the book, I rationally reconstruct, how did he see it so quickly? And yet, you know, the design inference implicated Madoff, I would say, decisively, and yet people would not take him to account because his reputation on Wall Street was so great. He was head of the NASDAQ for a while. The SEC was actually looking to him for advice, you know. So it's like, but the design inference actually ended up being a corrective to the sort of bias and people just believing in somebody's reputation without having a really good basis for it. So. I think there's a lot to be said for the design inference as a way of keeping us honest.
This is Apologetics Profile, a podcast ministry of Watchman Fellowship, equipping the church, exhorting the non-believer, and exalting Christ.